Have you ever woken up to find it impossible for a few brief moments to remember anything about who you are? Maybe a particularly intense dream was the cause, so caught in the nocturnal drama that you forgot about your life. Or perhaps the sleep was so restorative, so deep and quiet, that to return to reality is like returning from death, a deep blackness which had no use for the details of our lives. And that begs the question, just who are we? The you you looked at in the mirror 10 years ago is not the you we will see today. With enough resolve to change, you may be even different from the person tomorrow, and yet we are quick to assign titles, descriptions, and identities to ourselves and everyone we meet. What seemed to be so precious and indispensable as we decide how we will speak or act around others according to our desired individuality. We love to say things like, you are who you are, or people never change. And although this may be true in some instances, we should give credit to that other side of human nature, that which is flexible, which changes on a dime, which, given the right circumstances, will shed prior rules, codes of conduct, or morals for good or for ill. There are moments in our lives when we will decide to do things we previously thought unimaginable, either great acts of courage, cowardice, or malevolence. We will say things we only ever dared to think, maybe out of passion, jealousy, even despair. Behind the malleable skin of our expressions is an ever-rotating carousel of masks. And no matter how few or many we use, or how we think or feel they look, when somebody looks at us, we can never tell just who they are seeing. That is why I am telling you the final story of H.H. Holmes. A man, a serial killer who, just like us, woke up most days unable to stomach the thought of taking another human life. Although I know what I see when I look at him, I'm curious how he appears through your eyes. My name is Harlequin Grimm, and these are the stories of monsters whose voices are lost in history. And this is Mania. The first question people ask me when I tell them I'm writing episodes based on H.H. Holmes' autobiography is usually, H.H. Holmes has an autobiography. The serial killer is infamous enough that in circles where dark or macabre topics are favorites, his name is at once familiar. And if not, a brief introduction into his career is enough to make the writings of his personal mind seem all too interesting, if not incredibly disturbing. And they have been. There are two main sections of Holmes's autobiography. The first he penned while still under the notion that his freedom would yet be secured, or perhaps could be. Though Holmes was suspected of murder throughout much of his imprisonment, his arrests were often made because of his life insurance frauds. The number of times he did this, both successfully and not, are about as numerable as the alleged 27 instances of murder he eventually confesses to. During his recounts of insurance fraud, Holmes mentions the people associated to him who went missing. He professes his innocence and speaks of his discomfort with being held in captivity while defending himself. He provides evidence for the whereabouts of missing individuals, often in the form of letters, insisting that their sudden disappearances mere coincidence. How these letters come into existence, we will discover later. The evidence is enough to keep Holmes's death sentence at bay. During this time, he writes about his wife and how their bond is one of the few things keeping his spirits high as he fights for his liberty. In spite of the suspicious activity and the missing people, Holmes authors his defense much like any other person might. His words are earnest, desperate for freedom yet even-keeled, polite, careful not to slander, and completely lacking in any sense of panic, rage, contempt, or bad faith. Holmes's best defense was the blurred lines of murder and fraud. Seeing as how most of his insurance schemes dealt with the theft of corpses, the framing of their identities, and the forging of paperwork which would place their insurance claims in his bank account, you can see where there is a compelling story suggesting that Holmes did not create the dead bodies, merely located them and used them to his financial gain. That's what is so fascinating about Holmes. We love to hear stories about serial killers who succumb to a twisted passion, bloodshed, sadism, and demonic satisfaction in snuffing the life out of innocence. But Holmes's avidity for killing was born out of a spirit of entrepreneurship, or at least that's how it began. Inevitably, The roof of Holmes's house of cadavers caved in on him, crushing any hopes of freedom. Holmes took out a loan for the construction of a hotel during Chicago's World Fair. It attracted tenants, workers, and people from all walks of life. Little did they know, they were walking into a structure with rooms, halls, vaults, and equipment specifically designed for the killing and disposing of human beings. In a city where business and opportunity were ripe, Holmes decided to make human lives his secret business, product, and empire. At the peak of his financial wealth from all the lives he took, the bodies he stole, the identities he forged, he was spending approximately $240,000 a month in our time, quite comfortably. Holmes wasn't just an artist of death, he was an engineer, a con man, brilliant as he was morally deprived. If ever there was to be an inspiring story of pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, but meant for murderers, his would be the equivalent. The second section of Holmes's autobiography was written after the passing of his death sentence. Once all the bets were off, the narrative and even style of diction changed immediately. Holmes dropped the act of defending his innocence. Instead, he honestly recounts his murders, with each chapter simply titled Murder Number, followed by the name of his victim, before listing details and the motives like a very organized to-do list, which was completed. We see more of the calculating madman, more of the impulsive demon driving his intellect, and the curse of a forbidden appetite turned insatiable. My favorite part of this is his transparency. He speaks of his timidity with his first murder, the horror he felt in realizing he'd taken a human life. He talks about how his curiosity for killing was whetted, first by greed, but turned into something more intuitive. Some bodies were just jackpots, the key variable in life insurance schemes which would net him thousands upon thousands of dollars for a few days or weeks' work. Some bodies, which he sold to medical colleges for dissection, were standard fare, anywhere between $25 to $45, or in our time, around $650 to $1,100. Imagine looking at somebody and thinking, ah, I think I found this month's rent. Of course, no story is so simple. In the end, Holmes does admit of his own passion for killing, his indifference to human lives, and of the bizarre transition from bright-eyed surgeon and businessman to wielder of death. So let's get into it. The details, desires, the mishaps, all 27 of his alleged victims. But before we descend, let's hear a word of warning from the author himself. The following statement was written by me in Philadelphia County Prison for the Philadelphia Inquirer as a true and accurate confession in all particulars. It is the only confession of my fearful crimes I have made or will make. I write it fully appreciating all the horror it contains, though it condemns me before the world. I will proceed to the setting forth in all its horrid nakedness in the recital of the premeditated killing of 27 human beings and the unsuccessful attempts to take the lives of 6 others, thus branding myself as the most detestable criminal of modern times. A task so hard and distasteful that beside it the certainty that in a few days I am to be hanged by the neck until dead seems but a pastime. Acquired homicidal mania, save the occasional opportunity for pecuniary gain, is the only constant cause. April 6th, 1896. Murder number 1, Dr. Robert Leacock. Holmes's friend and former schoolmate was the first human life taken on October 5th, 1889, used for a case of insurance fraud that you'll find familiar from the last 2 episodes. The good doctor was a mere 32 years of age. Prior to his death, Holmes insists his prior deeds and thoughts never amounted to anything so sinister, but it was this body which awakened Holmes's appetite for blood. Previously unexplored, the newfound desire became a constant wonder in his mind. After this, he was always searching for the next victim. It should be noted that Holmes admits that this Dr. Leacock was the corpse he carted around Grand Rapids, Michigan. He did not, in fact, wait around a morgue for 2 weeks for fortune to strike. Murder number 2, Dr. Russell. The next victim was taken in the Chicago building Holmes had constructed. Even in his time, it was nicknamed the Castle. During an argument concerning some overdue rent due to Holmes, the ambitious landlord struck his tenant over the head with a chair. After a startled cry that was cut short by an anguished groan, it was Curtin's rear Dr. Russell. A bit anticlimactic, but what can you do? Here's an example of Holmes's problem with managing anger, a key part of his homicidal motives which he freely admits to. After realizing that he had committed his second killing, Holmes locked the doors in his office where this had occurred, giving himself a moment to consider his options of disposal. Being connected to medical colleges meant that Holmes often sold and purchased bodies. The bodies he purchased as a surgeon were under the pretense of dissection and study, but selling them was simply the same song and dance, reversed. Holmes had connections in the colleges which were less reputable, less legal than one would hope. Not only would they get rid of the body and put it to scientific use, Holmes would make a profit off it. Holmes mentions here that the man who he sold these bodies to, once the investigation was underway, could go from room to room of his hotel with several stories to tell for each one regarding each respective corpse. That's a hell of a way to do a tour. Murder number 3 and 4, Mrs. Julia L. Connor and her daughter Pearl. These victims were ushered into their graves due to a complicated relationship. Julia Connor's husband, Ned, lived in Holmes's castle. After Julia had an affair with Holmes, Ned filed for a divorce and left town. Holmes agreed to marry Julia as long as she also agreed to abort the child between them. The second condition was that she file, yes, you guessed it, a life insurance claim. Unsurprisingly, Julia was soon after butchered. Her child, Pearl, was given a lethal amount of chloroform, another favorite method of Holmes, you'll soon find. Years later, when the police were searching the hotel, they found what they believed to be the bones of Julia and Pearl. Though Holmes mentions accomplices in the act, they themselves were never found or named. Murder number 5, Rogers. In 1888, Holmes took a trip to West Morgantown, Vancouver, to stay for several weeks. There, he met a man named Rogers. After learning that this individual had quite a bit of money, he enticed him to go on a fishing trip. And there, in the tranquil scenery of a still lake, Holmes clubbed Rogers over the head with an oar. The body was found a month thereafter, waterlogged and bobbing hideously. Though this connection had somehow been denied in earlier trials, Holmes confesses to it, adding that 50 or more people in the town recognized his picture in the papers. Murder number 6, Charles Cole. After luring the representative of a lumber syndicate into his castle, Holmes got him talking. While the two discussed business ventures, an associate of Holmes readied a sturdy piece of gas pipe. Just as Holmes thought the tension was too much and he might give himself away, his associate brought the pipe down on Charles' skull, at once caving it in and spattering Holmes in a bit of his blood. Though he neglects to give specifics, judging by the stature of the victim and Holmes's known interest in lumber business, it can be assumed the motive for this was also, at first, financial. Murder number 7, Lizzie. Holmes wasn't only aided by other nefarious individuals with a taste for killing. In fact, Holmes had a handful of people working under him who seemed too precious to lose. One would imagine, due to their ability to stomach the way their boss dealt with unpaid rent. One such man was his janitor, Quinlan. Unfortunately for Lizzie, one of the hotel restaurant workers, Quinlan took a romantic interest in her. Fearing that it would get too far and he would lose Quinlan, Holmes invited Lizzie into a compartment of his hotel that you'll find rather charming. It was a vault. It didn't do too much. It opened, it closed, it was comprised of a thick steel door, brick and mortar, and not much else, really. But it was also a kind of printing press. Not literally, metaphorically. It was a printing press of deceit and alibis. You see, pretty much anybody who entered the vault often did so under the threat of Holmes trapping and suffocating them inside, unless they write letters to the necessary recipients to explain their sudden disappearance from Chicago. That was what was promised, after all. Their freedom, their life, an escape from the vault as long as they promised to leave the city, never to return. That never happened, of course, but Holmes always did get his letters. Weird how that you know, worked out for him. It would be a slow death in an airless, pitch-black chamber. And for Lizzie, it was quite an honor, being the first person to succumb to what was Holmes's perhaps favorite mechanism. Murders number 8, 9, and 10. Mrs. Sarah Cook, her child, and niece. One night in 1888, Holmes was preparing one of his bodies for shipment. It must have been late, as he assumed nobody was around. The awkward moment came when Mrs. Cook and her niece found themselves having barged in on the hotel owner himself during a most private ritual of body disposal. You can imagine the air in the room turning a bit sour. Miss Cook was Holmes's stenographer, somebody who transcribes speech to written word. She had a master key and had been showing her niece around before unwittingly consigning both her and her young daughter's soul to the grave. As you'll find, taking on the job of being Holmes's stenographer is basically signing your death certificate several months in advance. Before the two of them could recover from the terror of what they'd just seen, Holmes had them ushered into the vault we've just discovered. But before the door could be shut forever, there was one last piece of writing for Mrs. Cook to transcribe for her boss. Mrs. Cook had a husband. Husbands tend to get a bit flustered when their wives and nieces go missing without explanation. Mrs. Cook's sudden written declaration that she had tired of her life with him and had decided to take her daughter with her and pursuing another was an easy solution. Giving the devil his due, Holmes doesn't neglect to mention that Mrs. Cook was pregnant and counts this unborn child as yet another tally in his fatal toll. Murder number 11, Miss Emmeline Grand. Following the previous incident, there were some bloodied shoes to be filled now that Holmes had lost a valued stenographer. Everything was going fine with the replacement until Miss Grand became engaged and told Holmes that there was a date set for her wedding, which would simultaneously mark her leave from his employ. Holmes found this particularly, in his own words, obnoxious. Not only because Miss Grand had become indispensable in his office work, but because, well, she was also his mistress. There's no delicate way to put these stories, so I'm just going to give up. We have to give credit where credit was due. Holmes didn't go for the throat with this one, as we've established. He valued the work that Miss Grand did for him, so killing her out of frustration was just creating another problem. Instead, he went for her would-be husband. And it didn't work. So Holmes found himself at a familiar place, looking into the pleading eyes of yet another victim, after introducing them to a peculiar vault in his hotel. This method became clockwork. Victim is shown vault, victim is threatened, victim crumples into hysterical tears realizing they are meeting their doom. Holmes offers a way out via writing letters which misdirects the police, etc., etc. Miss Grant was very willing to do this, and prepared to leave the vault upon completing the letter, only to learn that the door would never be again opened until she had ceased to suffer the tortures of a slow and lingering death. Ah, the blunt honesty of H.H. Holmes. That same week, an eyewitness mentioned seeing Holmes and Quinlan carrying out a large trunk from the hotel. Wonder what that could have been. Miss Rosine Van Jessand. This one breaks the mold a bit, showing us a less methodical, more impulsive, and careless side of Holmes, which seemed to have flourished around this time of his career. Rosine was enticed to work at Holmes's fruit and confectionery store, not far from his hotel. But the location of the store would make it suspicious to carry out any particularly large shipments, like the last one. So her remains were buried in the store's basement. Funny how these things just kind of work out. But before her death, she had been forced to live with Holmes under the threat of dying if she appeared before any of his customers. And not long afterward, he administered ferrocyanide of potassium. Guess that little arrangement didn't work out too long. Murder number 13, Robert Latimer. You already know of Holmes's relationship to his janitor, Quinlan. Now, seeing as how this murder castle was quite the establishment with a good many rooms, you can imagine that there may have been multiple janitors. Robert Latimer was one of them, but not half as loyal as Quinlan. Even before Holmes had taken human life, Latimer was aware of the insurance schemes his boss had engaged in. Years later, he dug deep and found the courage to try and extort money from his boss with this information. Unfortunate for Latimer, by this time, Holmes had done a whole lot worse for a whole lot less. In his own beautifully barbaric words, Holmes said, "His own death and the sale of his body was the recompense given to him." Only, suffocation wasn't enough for this one. Holmes used the same vault, but gave Latimer oxygen enough to live so that he would starve first. But seeing as how Holmes was a busy man, and that he needed the vault for other purposes, and finding his pleading unbearable, he actually ended Robert's life early. When the police investigated the hotel and found the fatal vault, there was evidence of claw marks and some desperate attempts to excavate the walls. Latimer had attempted to tear away the brick and mortar with all he had, his fingers. Murder number 14, Miss Anna Betts. For all we know, this one was just for entertainment. Holmes had a method to his madness for the majority of his killings, though for Miss Betts, Holmes' confession leads us to a strange conclusion. During his career, Holmes worked at a drugstore, a necessary step in the construction of his hotel. But during this time, a prescription had been sent to him to be filled. And he filled it. With poison. Though he neglects the details of the particular substance he used to replace her medicine, suffice it to say, whatever Miss Betts took was a fatal dose. As for motive, well, when this killing came to light, authorities suggested there was a debt between him and the victim which needed to be settled. Which was true. However, Holmes also added that the debt had been paid for before she died, and that this killing was, for all intents and purposes, little else than a personal indulgence. Murder number 15, Miss Gertrude Connor. As perhaps you've noticed, Holmes has a way of trying out a particular method on several people before moving on. We saw his little spree with the vault he used to suffocate victims, and how this, an odd habit of replacing people's prescription drugs with poison. The only difference between this victim and the one before is that Miss Connor left Chicago immediately, so the poison took effect by the time she had reached her home in Iowa. In conclusion, Holmes states, "Perhaps these two cases show more plainly than any others the light regard I had for the lives of my fellow beings." No, we sort of caught wind of that when you said you walloped somebody to death with a chair. Murder number 16, Miss Kate Durkee. This story is about as bizarre as it is brutal, as it's alleged that the victim of the murder was interviewed following Holmes' execution. Quite plainly, Durkee stated, "I was never killed by Holmes or anyone else." I'm not really sure why she felt the need to further clarify that nobody else had killed her, but okay. Despite the evidence coming to the other authorities, I don't like distrusting Holmes' last written word. It's clear from the aftermath that he was quite right about himself. He suffered from a kind of homicidal mania, inducing behaviors which he himself reported to be shocked by following his episodes. The question is just how much of his memory can we trust? On one hand, future reports show that several of the victims listed here did not, in fact, conclusively die. Either their bodies were never found, their identity was never confirmed, or, in this case, the victim themselves denied the story ever happening. And yet, on the other hand, with cases such as the pharmaceutical killing, Holmes's reckless behavior, distorted memory, and unpredictable nature seem to suggest that there are even more murders than have been accounted for. Which makes you wonder, just who is Holmes talking about as he recalls the following murder? He purports to have lured a young woman who owned valuable real estate in Chicago, where he acted as her agent. Causing her to believe that there was an investment opportunity for her, he convinced her to convert her holdings into cash. Having done this, it was a simple ritual of luring her into his office and finally the vault. After having passed within, Holmes listened to her screams as he had others, though these were inflamed by the anguish of having not only her life stolen from her, but understanding how an immense fortune had just been conned out of her. Following his confession, Holmes mentions the report of having also killed the victim's sister, and that this allegation was actually contradicted properly. Murder number 17, Mr. Warner. The next victim you'll find hits the same satisfying notes of betrayal and irony often found in an Edgar Allan Poe story. Mr. Warner was the founder of the Warner Glass Bending Company, another prime investment for Holmes once he had secured two checks from the gentleman, adding the word thousand to their written denominations. The two businessmen had come to know each other because Holmes had hired Mr. Warner to build a kiln in the castle basement, a large specialized furnace which could reach incredible temperatures at the flick of a switch. Such creations were commonplace in Mr. Warner's business. Once the furnace was finished, Holmes invited Mr. Warner in to explain how the structure worked. It was about the size of a room, quite large, and more than enough for two or several men to fit in. Saying that he had left something outside, Holmes left Warner to wonder what the object might have been, and then to wonder why the door to the furnace had been shut. Before Warner could scream, a jet of flame ignited from a small window built into the door. Once the oil was activated to its fullest extent, the furnace was filled with a colorless flame, intense enough to make Warner's suffering very brief indeed. Despite the poetic method behind the murder, Mr. Warner was confirmed to be alive when this confession was made, which once more only draws out more questions. Why would Holmes lie? And who, if anyone, did he actually kill in Mr. Warner's place? Murder number 18, Mr. Rogers. An older, wealthy banker from North Wisconsin was enticed by Holmes and an English associate to appear at the castle. The old pattern of extortion was implemented, but found itself hitting some difficulties when the victim, too old to care for his life, and not young enough to amass another fortune should he be given his life, was not so readily convinced to sign away his wealth. It was by starving, then nauseating him with gas, that Rogers was forced to sign the required documents presented by Holmes and his associate, an expert forger. Under the pretense that he would be allowed to live should he sign his name to the correlating documents, Holmes had his associate administer chloroform, then disposed of the body himself. Murder number 19, a female boarder. It was not just business associates, but even the tenants and customers of the hotel which found themselves entangled in Holmes's passion. After a woman boarded in the castle, a tenant of Holmes took a liking to her, but this affection came into conflict with a tenant's marriage, at which point the tenant sought the time-proven and sage advice of a self-professed maniac and killer. Seeing an opportunity to have yet another individual under his thumb, Holmes advised that he live with the woman for a time, and if it threatened his marriage or disrupted his life too heavily, that they would kill the boarder and divide her wealth amongst the two. Perhaps this murderous suggestion was soon over the course of a good many stressful nights with a cheating husband. I have a hard time believing it was the first thing that Holmes proposed when sought after for advice, but whatever convinced the husband didn't take long. When the night came, the tenant held down the woman while Holmes administered chloroform. It was the body of this woman within a long coffin-shaped box, which was taken from the castle in 1893, of which the police were notified. Murder number 20 and 21, Minnie and Nanny Williams. Next door, a rather unfortunate pair of sisters. Miss Minnie R. Williams first met Holmes in New York in 1888, where she knew him as Edward Hatch. In 1893, he was later introduced to her again as H.H. Holmes, where she had applied for the position as a stenographer. Both sisters owned a southern real estate. Over the course of their relationship, Holmes acted as a parasite, extracting what wealth he could from them. Nanny was the first to be disposed of after she was lured to the castle. She had died and written a letter under duress, which explained that she decided not to visit her sister in Chicago at all. But before Holmes could descend on the remaining sister, a fire in the castle interrupted his usual methods. Traveling 8 miles outside of a town called Moments in Illinois, he ended her life by administering poison. Her body was buried in the basement of a home in Irvington, Indiana. Murder number 22, unknown man. A man who came to attend the Chicago Exposition was Holmes' next victim. Intending to use this man in his business dealings but finding him less capable than he thought, Holmes decided to kill him. After having lost contact with what he called his stiff dealer, who would purchase corpses off Holmes, he decided to bury him in a home he owned on the corner of 74th and Honoré Street in Chicago. Holmes states that, should one dig deeply in the sandy soil, the body will be found. Murder number 23, Baldwin Williams. Now we return to yet another Williams, as our entrepreneur was evidently dissatisfied in leaving a remaining piece of the lineage in a family he had all but destroyed. Among the belongings left behind by Manny Williams was an insurance policy made in her favor by her brother, Baldwin, who lived in Ladville, Colorado. Obviously, there was only one thing left to do. Holmes promptly left that city in 1894, and having found him, took a break from his pharmaceuticals and just shot the man. So you see, Holmes is like a bounty hunter. Except, instead of bounties, these are mere possibilities of wealth, or insurance policies, worth defrauding. And instead of criminals or people who deserve justice, they're unsuspecting, innocent civilians. Yeah, so I guess he's really nothing like a bounty hunter. But you can't say he hasn't been productive with his vocation. Murder number 24. Benjamin F. Pitezel. To adequately understand Holmes' particular resolve with this case, I'll be quoting directly from his confession. Benjamin represented a special instance where Holmes allowed his scheme to come to fruition over many years. Coming upon his final murders involving blood relatives of Benjamin, we find ourselves stumbling upon what is little else than a finale of depravity. Having never sunk lower morally, nor sown so much hatred into a single set of murders, Holmes proves himself to be utterly irredeemable. Where before his odd, fatal explorations seemed to bounce from victim to victim, now we can understand that his art was an obsession, an addiction, and a black vocation for which he would surely only pursue in greater numbers if he was allowed to go on. Concerning Benjamin, he wrote, "It will be understood that from the first hour of our acquaintance, even before I knew he had a family, who later afforded me additional victims for the gratification of my bloodthirstiness, I intended to kill him. All steps taken to gain his confidence and that of his family were taken so that when the time came and the time was ripe, they would more readily fall into my hands." In a rare moment of rearing a truly demonic head, Holmes then reflects on how foolish he was to expect to feel, quote, "sufficient satisfaction" in witnessing their deaths, as he felt that the plan taken invested a disproportionate amount of time. And indeed, 7 years was a lot longer than his usual plans. Yet, so it is, and it furnishes a very striking illustration of the vagaries in which the human mind will, under certain circumstances, indulge, the delusions of the exponents of perpetual motion, or the dreams of the fiend, are sanity itself. Benjamin had a weakness for alcohol which Holmes exploited. In many cases where Holmes would have his victims write letters, in this instance Holmes took up the pen himself, writing Benjamin letters from his wife, discouraging him enough to cause him to resort to drink. Benjamin worked and lived in the castle with Holmes, away from his family, and as such was entirely victim to his complete manipulation. As you can imagine, the motives for such a long, drawn-out scheme were the collected life insurance policies of the entire Pitezel family, what he nurtured for 7 years. When the time came, Holmes prepared to travel to Callow Hill Street, where Benjamin had a house and lived alone. It was at this point that he found his letters had worked just as he had suspected, causing Benjamin to resort to his alcoholism. In the second story, Holmes found Benjamin insensibly drunk, while his friend slurred, helplessly, unaware that a friend and boss was preparing to end his life, Holmes bound Benjamin. He saturated his clothing and face with benzene, and in the broad light of day, tossed a match onto him. But even the amount of alcohol Benjamin had proved insufficient to subdue the sobriety, which inevitably rose up in the death throes. Benjamin was clear enough at the end to beg for a faster death, and to writhe in such a way that left an impression on Holmes. Specifically, the author of his own confession wonders just how far the depths of his insanity reached, and he still wonders at his inability to feel much remorse at all despite the suffering caused. After Benjamin's struggle was over, Holmes extinguished the remaining flames, removed the ropes that had bound him, and poured chloroform into his stomach so as to suggest an accidental death to the medical examiner. Holmes endeavored for the fire to be deduced as an explosion caused by the mistaken mixing of cleaning fluid, such as benzene and chloroform. Murder number 25, Howard Pitezel. Now we return to the house in Irvington, Indiana, for the final three murders in Holmes's career. On the 8th of October, 1894, early in the afternoon, Holmes went to a repair shop where he had previously left a set of long knives to be sharpened. On October 10th, a stove was delivered to the house as well. It arrived at around 6 p.m. Inside was Holmes himself, and besides perhaps other victims buried in the basement, was the son of Benjamin Bedazzle, a young boy. Not long after the stove was delivered did Holmes administer a fatal dose of medicine to the boy. As soon as his breathing had stopped, Holmes cut Howard into small enough pieces, thus allowing him to pass through the door of the stove. It is at this point that, without a semblance of doubt, we can assume that Holmes was not merely driven by greed, an unmanageable temper, or even medical curiosity. Rather, or perhaps just as well, for the pure satisfaction in hearing cries for mercies, pleas for swifter deaths, and watching the mechanisms which allow for human life to come to halts beneath his hands. Murder number 26 and number 27, Alice and Nellie Bedazzle. The final two victims are the end of the rope in Holmes' career. Alice was the oldest of the three children whose lives were taken. 15 days following their brother's demise, the children were brought to a house which Holmes rented on Vincent Street in Toronto. Only adding to Holmes' callousness, he would see Mrs. Bedazzle, the children's mother, that day, under the pretense of solidifying his alibi and having purchased for the boy a set of clothes. Holmes was, at this time, a trusted friend of the family, so much so that the mother left her children under his care. But at this time, the children were not so much under his care as they were imprisoned in the home he trapped them in. Specifically, a large chest whose only air hole had been sealed and attached to a hose. At around 8 p.m. that day, Holmes returned to a room in the house which lacked all furnishing save for the chest which held the two quiet souls, whose lives were taken by the slow suffocation of gas then administered by their caretaker. These children had looked to Holmes even more so than their own father, who, perhaps often intoxicated, financially unstable and unreliable, at least had not been plotting their demise from before they could even speak properly. Mrs. Bedazzle and her two remaining children, luckily enough, were spared from Holmes's destruction. To examine the nature of our subject is akin to making sense of a feral beast having been set loose on an organized society. Some shadows which grow out from the silhouette of people become large enough to engulf entire cities, and though we may throw at it every explanation psychologists can provide, it may suffice it to say, and perhaps be more direct, to simply suggest that for some people, murder is merely nature. In examining the career of great musicians, scientists, or engineers, we suspect fully that each achievement will overshadow the last, that their passion will merely intensify, and their careers peak. To apply a different set of expectations to people such as H.H. Holmes seems wholly unproductive, even naive, insofar as killing becomes a kind of career, or murder their art. But less obvious is the fact that Holmes was aware of his own developing condition. Throughout his confessions, he is not without the occasional reflection, revealing hints of surprise at even his own actions in retrospect, his awareness that he is special in a horrible way. Why can some people withstand the sight of blood while others grow pale? Why can some people dissect corpses for autopsies, carry them out of homes, or indeed be the last force of nature which takes their life, while others recoil at even the thought of such work? Before I started my job as an undertaker, I trembled in the moments leading up to seeing my first corpse, my nose wrinkled at a medical examiner's office when I stood above an autopsied murder victim whose age was closer to those of Holmes's last victims. By the end of my first week, I looked on at people's bodies the way one notices flowers in a room at a florist's shop. People often think that what it takes to be a murderer is some nature beyond the pale of normal people like you and I. What my work taught me is that those who can stomach it are perhaps not as special as people think. Sure, Not every pianist is Beethoven, but with enough practice or given the opportunity, most people can learn to play a song or two. Whether we like it or not, the potential is there. For most of us, it's not a matter of when, but a matter of if and what, which is capable of dragging the monster out of us. As for those for whom it is a matter of when, let's just hope it's not you that becomes their first who. Thank you for listening to this episode of Mania. If you'd like a free book on the house, head on over to audibletrial.com/mania. Once again, that's audibletrial.com/mania. Not only will you be enjoying an audiobook of your choosing, but you'll be supporting the show while you read. And if you'd like to support my work directly, feel free to visit patreon.com/harlequingrim. Once again, that is patreon.com/harlequingrim. There, you can donate however much you'd like to the show. Anything $10 or under will net you subscriber-only exclusives, such as handwritten letters from me, or more dark stories only available to supporters like you. I really must thank all of those who listen to Mania. Your support, enthusiasm, and willingness to share the show is a crucial element in this theater coming to life. Thank you for being you. Stay haunted. I do sincerely hope you'll join me next time.